Okay, so why don't we get started? Just want to ask if there are any questions on the programming assignment. I'm hoping all of you have at least looked at it, have gotten some work going due soon. Yeah, don't wait until the very end to do the bulk of the work. Yeah, question.
For the leader election stuff, was it just a handle like basically like a node dropped off? And then reappears, or are we just kind of simulating that people
get... Yeah, so for now there are no real failures in the system. In the third assignment we will probably have nodes failing and things like that. But to if there are no failures, then obviously once you elect a leader, the leader is not going to change. Right, so to check that your leader election works, your test cases should have something where a leader can resign rather than a node failing. So the leader resigns and the new election is started. So you can do that just to show that your technique actually works. Otherwise, you'll just have a stable leader. It won't change. Yeah, you have a question?
The two that you have to implement, the synchronization and the leader election, is there a possibility where it happens at the same time? Do we have to make the system such that simultaneously? Like
the leader election? No.
Leader election and the synchronization, could there be like calls for both at the same time?
So I assume that you don't have to deal with that part. I mean, you could of course queue up the requests and so on. But right now you don't really need to deal with that issue. Okay, you can assume that the leader is elected, and while the leader election is in progress, you don't have to deal with the request for locks. I mean, in some sense you have to queue it, but you can assume you don't send those.
So another question I have with respect to the synchronization is, like, how often do we need to synchronize?
How often do you need to synchronize?
Clock synchronization,
okay. I thought when you meant synchronization, you're talking about lock. Clock synchronization, I mean, you can decide. You can, of course, the standard way to do it is you actually pick the drift rate. You can pick a reasonable value and say if you want the clocks to be synchronized within some value, then you had the drift rate, the tolerance over drift rate is the period. Okay, so but here, I mean, since your simulations are, rather the system is not going to run for a long time. You probably, your tests will run for minutes at the very, so it's not like you will actually trigger your clock synchronization. So you could just pick a simple static period, it would be okay. That would be fine. Okay. So any reasonable decisions are okay. We don't want to trivialize it, but no need to overcomplicate it either. But do note all the decisions you have made.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, your question.
So when a node resigns, that means it also does not take part in the election that follows, right?
When a node resigns, it will not take part in the election that follows. That, yes. Yeah. Yeah, otherwise, it will become the leader again. If it is the highest, yeah. There was a question back there? Okay. Alright, so I'm just going to continue our discussion from last time. So just to do a quick recap, we talked about consistency and replication. I mentioned that you use replication for getting higher availability or improving reliability, because if some node crashes, some other node can take over. And you also use replication for scalability. If a single machine cannot handle the workload that your application sees, then you have to replicate the application code or data or both on multiple machines in order to scale beyond the capabilities of a single machine. And then the issue was, whenever you replicate data, you have the problem of consistency that goes along with it. And the issue is, if you have multiple copies of the same data item, and one of them is updated and the other ones are out of date or inconsistent, then what techniques do you use to ensure that they are all consistent? Because readers can go and read them from any replica, and you don't want to respond with older copies or older versions of that data item. Okay? So we looked at a range of consistency semantics, starting from strict all the way to weak last time. Okay, and all of those were semantics that you can provide. We didn't really show how you can implement those semantics. Keep that in mind. They were just definitions saying here are different semantics one your application can provide. Today we will see some glimpses of how you go about implementing them. Okay? But before we do that, I want to finish the discussion on eventual consistency. So I did mention what is eventual consistency. So here you are not providing any specific guarantees on consistency. You are just saying that if you have a system where there are replicas of data items and some of those data items are updated, and you assume that replicas do pairwise exchange, when two replicas talk to one another, you say these are updates I have seen, and you push them to the other one, and then you pull all the updates that replica has seen that you haven't. Okay, so you do pairwise exchange of any updates that have occurred at each replica, and the hope is by doing this, okay, over some period of time all replicas will catch up. Okay, any write at any one replica will propagate through the system using this pairwise exchange. I mean, that replica will exchange with some other replicas, and that write propagates and so on and so forth. Okay. Now the question is, how do you go about implementing a technique like this? To understand that, we introduce this notion of an epidemic protocol, okay, which was based on this theory of how diseases or real viruses spread through pairwise exchange. Okay, so we had this notion of infected store, which is a store that has an update, and it would like to infect stores that haven't seen it by pushing this update. Okay, through pairwise exchange. So there are susceptible stores and infective stores. Infective stores would like to spread this and then get the update to all of the replicas in the system. So two techniques that we, this is where we stopped last time. So we had this anti-entropy technique where a server P, okay, picks a server Q at random and they exchange updates. Okay, this is your pairwise exchange. So there are three possibilities. A push-based scenario where P pushes all the updates it has seen to Q, but not vice versa. Or you can have only pull where P asks Q to send it all of the changes it has seen, or any time P and Q talk to another, you have both push and pull. One, you push and then you pull. Okay? Clearly, that's the most efficient thing to do. If you only push, then Q might have some updates that you don't get advantage of. You cannot take advantage of. Okay? Now, there's a claim here which says a pure push-based approach does not help spread updates quickly. Now, it should be clear that if you want to spread updates as quickly as possible to bring all the replicas up to date or make them consistent, you should have both push and pull. Okay? The question is, why does a pure push-based approach not spread the updates quickly? Eventually, any of these techniques will make all the replicas consistent. So eventually, the update is going to trickle. It's random exchange through random pairwise interactions. But the question is, if you want to do it as quickly as possible, you don't want only a push-based approach. For that matter, only a pull-based approach. Any thoughts? Okay. So why is it that you said push-based will not spread it quickly?
Because let's say there are 100 systems and only one of the publishers is trying to push it. It will there will be a delay in which the updated content is actually replicated in all the 100 systems. But if there are pull-based approach and push-based approach, when the updated content is passed on to 10 pages, the other client will actually receive it from the updated one. But
right. So let me draw a picture just to explain. So assume these are servers. Okay, so here is a server that has received data item which is blue, and none of the other servers have seen this update. So you want to push this out. Okay. Initially the push based approach is going to work well, because whenever this server contacts any of these other servers at random, none of them have seen this update. Okay. So it can just push it out. Okay, so let's assume it contacts. So this one has to pick a server at random and keep doing it. So let's say it picks this, and now this server has the update, and then it picks someone else and that server, and each of them have to do the same thing. So once this gets it, there are three servers that are pushing out the update and so on. So then you go here and you push this up. Okay. Now the problem with the push approach is when the update has been propagated to a lot of machines, but there's a very small minority that hasn't yet seen it, push will not work very well. Because what will happen is you will pick another server and that server has already seen that update. So there is nothing to send at this point. Okay. So in this case, the pull-based approach works better, because servers that are trying to actively go and look for updates we'll be able to pull it. In particular, this server, in this scenario, if it picks any server at random, okay, it will pull that update quickly. Okay. So the point is, a push-based approach works well in the initial stage of spreading the update. Yeah, because no one else has seen it, so you can spread it as quickly as possible and infect other stores. But when there's a small minority remaining of servers, then push-based doesn't work, because most of the servers that you contact at random have already seen it. So you might have the small fraction that doesn't get infected quickly. After a long period, it will. It's just that how quickly can you do it, yes.
But when the server gets an update, will it go for a push? Will it contact some other servers to push it? Suppose one which has got an update right now, will it go start the search to push it?
Yes, this process is happening randomly. At random points in time, a server says, I want to try to spread something. Okay, so you will go pick another server at random and say, here are some updates I have seen, and you try to push it that way. Okay, that's the basic technique. What is the question you are asking? I didn't quite understand.
When one server gets the update, it can start contacting other servers.
Yes.
So then there is a possibility that it can be
faster,
push can be faster.
So in the initial phase, it is going to grow exponentially, right? It's geometric. So this one contacts this, now there are two that are trying to spread it. Now these two, each of them will contact some other, so there will be four. So it sort of grows 2 to the power n, right? So, but eventually what will happen is most of the servers in the system have seen it. So it grows very quickly. But then it levels off, because most of the servers are just doing wasted work, because everyone else. So when this gets the update for the first time, it doesn't know who else has it. So it might contact some of the servers that have already seen it, right? Because of this, the probability, there are four others, and the probability it will contact this one is 25%, and the probability there is 75%. So that's the point. And it is the exact opposite. If you have a pull-based approach, what happens is the exact opposite. Which is, in the initial phase, it's very slow, because these servers are just, so let's say this server just contacts a server at random saying, have you seen an update? It might contact that server, it hasn't seen anything. So you're doing wasted work in the initial phase. Eventually some server will contact this server and say, do you have an update? And this update will spread using a pull-based approach. Okay? So a pull-based approach is slow in the initial phase, very good at the tail end. A push base is slow, is very fast at the initial spreading, but not so good at the send update to everyone else. Okay, but if you have both, then it should be clear that you can spread the update very quickly. Okay, both in the initial phase as well as towards the end. Okay, that is anti-entropy. Okay, the other technique that I just mentioned last time was rumor mongering, also known as gossiping. This is basically based on how rumors spread. And if you know something that you want to tell everyone that you know, you will contact your friend and say, I heard this this thing. And then this is how rumors will spread. Very similar to how you spread diseases. Okay? The technique here is basically as follows. It's called so-called gossiping. Upon receiving an update, server P will try to push it to Q. Okay. If Q has already heard this update, you will toss a coin. Okay. With probability 1 over K, you might stop, or probability 1 minus 1 over K, you will continue to spread. Okay. So the issue is, if everyone has already seen it, you start backing off, saying this is no longer a hot news item, everybody seems to know it, become common knowledge. So there's no point you keep calling your friends and say, I heard something. Okay. So it's a probabilistic algorithm, also similar to that, but it's a push-based with a back-off built-in. Okay, it says, when do you stop? Okay, you stop when if somebody you contact has already seen it, you will toss a coin. Okay, and then you will stop with probability 1 over K. So eventually, if you keep seeing the machines that have already seen this, you will basically toss the coin and it will tell you to stop. So that node will stop, and others will use the same algorithm. So in this system, the chances that update does not spread to anyone is non-zero, because if everyone backs off, it's a push-based approach. So if all nodes back off, all nodes that have seen the update back off, then the nodes that haven't seen will not receive it anymore. It's a pure push-based approach, and this is the probability. You can analyze it, not going to do the analysis here, but it's e to the power k plus 1 times 1 minus s is the chances that you will say susceptible. That's S itself. Okay, it depends on the probability of back off. Okay, that probability is very high. Let's say it's 0.9. So the first time you contact someone that has already seen the update, you toss a coin with probability 0.9, you stop. Okay, so the 90% probability you will stop very quickly. On the other hand, if that probability value is very low, let's say it's 0.1, yeah, as opposed to 0.9, if you see someone that's already seen an update, your chances are you'll keep going, keep trying to spread it. Okay, so you can pick the value of K and then get an appropriate percentage of nodes that never see an update. Okay, very similar to gossip, right? I mean, not the case that if there's a hot rumor that everyone will eventually hear it. A large fraction of your population might hear it, but not everyone. Okay, so that's epidemic protocol. Now, there's one problem with epidemic protocol, which is deletion. Okay? Updates are easy. Okay, so whenever you have an update, you can spread it. Adding new data items is also easy because that's like an update. It's the first time you create a data item, you sort of also updated it. So you can create data items and they'll spread quickly through the system. Okay? Deletions are where the problem is. Okay, so let's suppose that there's a data item that you have now replicated and you go to some node and say you delete this file. Okay, let's say data item is a file. You delete it. Okay, now what happens? So that any record of that files ever having ever existed is gone because you just deleted it. So when this data item this server contacts some other server saying, send me all the data I don't have. Okay, this server will say, okay, you don't have this file here, take it back. Okay, so you have basically taken a file that was deleted and recreated it. Right? Is that clear what the problem is? So the issue is you cannot distinguish between deleted data items and data item and updates that you have never received in the first place. Okay, because when you take a look at the files at one machine and files at some other machine and do the diff, you'll say here are some files that this machine has that I don't have, so you just take it back. Okay, although you had it and you deleted it. Okay, so to address this issue, so basic point is you cannot distinguish between a deleted copy and no copy. So the solution is you don't actually delete data items, but you keep those data items and you mark them deleted. Okay, so it's like a last update that you make to the data item saying this is now a deleted data item. Okay? And that's the update you want to spread. You don't want to actually delete that data item. You just want to take the delete command and just mark this data item as deleted, but keep it, okay, as an update. And so that's called a death certificate. So you treat deletes as updates and start spreading this death certificate through the system. Okay, so that looks like a new update to the data item. When you spread it, eventually all the machines will receive this update and everyone will know that this was deleted. Yeah, this is how you handle it. So in this system, you can never really delete once you create. Okay, because the moment you actually delete, this deletion can cause the data item to start spreading again as a new update. Yes. Yes. You can assume that there is going to be, you are wasting storage. There is nothing you can do. Only time you can actually delete is if you are guaranteed that everyone has seen the death certificate. At that point you can go and ask everyone to delete all at once. Otherwise you cannot do it. But there is no concept of talking to all replicas because it's a weakly connected system. So there is nothing you can do other than to mark it as an object that existed in the past and has been deleted. Okay. It's not as bad as it looks. I mean, if you think about it, your storage space is growing at a rate where you can get a 1 terabyte disk. If it's one file with 4 kilobytes, who cares? You can just keep it around. Okay. Many systems do that in any case, right? Because a file system that will keep track of deleted data but not actually wipe it out, so you can undelete at a later time. For other reasons, you might want to keep it. Okay. That's a separate issue, but that's the disadvantage. I mean, you can think of it as an overhead or a limitation of the approach. Yes, question.
What happens to the copies which are, if one file is marked for deletion and that is spread, so all of them converted to deletion?
Yeah.
Is it stored in a central repository or each server has its own file?
Yeah. So in this system, there is no central repository. Okay. Every server has its own repository. So you have to all keep all copies. Yes, each of the server has to keep that record and mark it deleted. Okay. And then eventually you can have a cleanup phase, but you have to be careful and ensure that everyone saw it before you do it. Okay, so that is eventual consistency. So that basically concludes the discussion of semantics, okay, or consistency models, which have gone all the way from strict to eventual, which is not giving you any guarantee. Okay, think, as I mentioned, in eventual consistency, there's no time limit put on when all the nodes are going to see an update. So until that update has actually spread, some nodes will have an old version of the data item and some will have a new version. And depending on which node you contact, you may get either your old version or a new version. So there are no consistency guarantees. Okay? So this is the weakest of the models we have studied. And on the other end of the spectrum, we had strict, which said as soon as you change it, propagate that update immediately to all the replicas. So everyone is always consistent and up to date. Okay, here, you can be out of date for very long periods of time. So that's the background on models. So now we will talk about implementing some of these consistency models. Okay, there are two techniques we will look at. One is called primary based. Okay, and in a primary based model, there is a primary replica that is responsible for maintaining the most up-to-date version of the data item always. Okay, so there's a primary for each data item. Different replicas may be primaries for different data items. It's not like there's one centralized system. But for every data item in the system, there is one primary and everyone else is secondary. So that's one class of techniques. The other, which is called primary based, there's replicated write protocols where you do not assume any primary. Okay, you assume there are replicas. No replica is more distinguished than the other. Everyone is equal. Okay. So there is a question of how do you implement any of those models using a primary based technique. How do you implement any of those using a replicated write technique? Okay. So I'm not going to go into all of the models and show how you implement every one using this and this. Rather, we'll take some point solution and see what the primary one does, what the replicated write does. Okay. So let's start with the primary based protocol. So here, this picture is showing you is a primary based remote write protocol. Okay. So here are four replicas of your data store. Okay. And we'll assume that this replica here, which is a server, is the primary for a data item X. Okay. So in this case, the way things are going to work is any of these stores can reply to read requests. Okay. And there you have to do something extra for write requests. And here is here the examples are as follows. So those two machines are client, they are reading the same data item X. Okay. One is sending the request to this machine, the other one is sending the request to this machine. And you want to ensure that whatever comes out is consistent regardless of which machine you contact. Okay. So the very simple thing you could do, so if you actually send a write, so let's say you want to update, W1 is a write request that has come to this data store. Okay. In a primary based system, you always have to send all write requests to the primary because that's the coordinator. So in this case, this W1 is actually just forwarded here. Okay, in step 2, you just send a write there, and then the server is going to actually perform the write, send an acknowledgement, that's step 3, and then the client gets an acknowledgement. Okay. So essentially what you are doing is every update, regardless of where it comes, is just sent to the primary, saying you deal with it. Okay. Now after you have actually received the update, you have to then propagate that update to all the other replicas. That part is not shown here. I'll show that on the next slide. But all that you are showing here is every write is actually sent to the primary for processing. And in this case, if you don't have replication, then every read will also be sent to the primary. But if you have replication, as we will show in the next slide, here are the things that need to happen. So initially the write came. Okay, the write was sent to the primary. Now the primary actually has to broadcast the write to other replicas. In this case, we'll assume there's only one other replica, which is that one here. So in step 3, you send that write to the backup saying, I received an update, here it is. Okay. And the backup sends an acknowledgement that I received it. Now you know that both replicas have seen the write. Okay, so your primary broadcasts the write out, gets back acknowledgement, and then once that comes in, you send an acknowledgement to the client. Okay. Very simple implementation. Now in this case, and you can see that here the write is broadcast also to this replica. In step W3 is going out here, it's gone out there, it's gone out here. Okay, so basically the primary is responsible for ensuring all replicas are up to date. Now in this case, the reads can be processed locally. Okay, because every replica is being kept up to date. Any read request at any of those disks can be handled locally. In particular, a read comes here. This disk actually has the most up to date version of the data item, so it can reply immediately. Okay. So writes are more expensive because writes have to be broadcast. Reads can be local. Okay, because any server you contact already has the most up to date version. Okay. This is called remote write protocols. When we come back to distributed file system, we will look at this one more time. Okay, because there will be a server that has a copy of the file. The file may be cached at multiple client sites. Whenever you perform an update at the server has to actually either send invalidates or updates to all the caches. Otherwise, if any other client actually tries to read that file locally, you might get an old version of the file. Okay, so we'll come back to this, look at implementations of this later. Okay. So here is another way to implement all of these techniques. This is called local write protocol. The first one was remote writes. So here you have local writes. So what you want to do here is ensure that writes are also local. Okay. So what would happen in this case is that the primary has to keep changing from one machine to another. Okay. In the previous case, the primary didn't change. The primary was designated as this machine. It didn't change. Okay. It was always the primary. If you relax that assumption and you let the primary keep changing, then you can make writes local. And here is how you can do that. So let's assume that client wants to write to a file. Okay. The primary of that file is this machine. Okay, same as last time. But in this case, rather than forwarding the write to that machine, you actually change the primary, you switch the primary. You say the writes are taking place here, so this machine delegates the writes of being primary to this machine and sends the file over. Okay. So now this machine has taken over as the primary, so it's the new server for data item X. So the write can actually then be performed locally instead of the write having to be sent to another machine. Okay. Is that clear what I just said? This doesn't change the fact that you still have to broadcast the write. Okay. This primary will still have to broadcast it to all other replicas, except that because the updates on the clients are coming to that machine, it becomes the new primary for this machine. Okay, yes, there's a question.
What happens when there are parallel clients which tries to access?
Yes, good question. So what happens if there is parallel clients? So before I discuss what you just asked, let me also mention that. So if you look at NFS or network file system, we will specifically look at NFS version 4. Okay, when we talk about distributed file system, you will see that NFS version 4 actually implements a technique like this. It's called delegation. Okay. So there is a one server that has the file, but if it sees that there are lots of writes happening at a particular machine, it can delegate access to that file to the client. So the file is actually sent over to the server. This client becomes a temporary server for that machine. Okay. And at any later time, you can bring the file back if you want to. Okay. So this is done for performance reason. Okay, so the writes can be local and you can the client performance throughput will improve. Okay, now let's come back to the question that was asked me. What happens if there are multiple writers in the system? One writer, multiple readers is not a problem. Okay, the primary where the writes are taking place, the machine where the writes are taking place is the primary. It keeps broadcasting the writes to all other replicas, so replicas are kept up to date and reads are local. Okay, multiple readers, one writer is never a problem. Multiple writers, concurrent writers is an issue. Okay. In particular, if there's another client here doing a write and one client there doing a write, then what should you do? Who is the primary?
Yes. You have a lock on the file so that it'll get back, once the file gets copied back over to that first server and it becomes the new server, then that third guy doesn't have anything, you have to go all the way over there.
Okay. Yes, that's not the same as saying we have a lock on the file. You just basically say that there is a primary. Okay. If there are multiple writers, then you cannot keep changing the primary. You just let whoever is the primary be the primary. And this writes that are coming to this store have to basically follow the remote write protocol, meaning they have to be forwarded to the primary. Okay. Because there's not much you can do. If there are multiple concurrent writers, you can still have only one primary. So you basically everyone else forwards the writes to that primary.
You connect in the server at the same time, but you have to give one priority, right?
If you have both clients sending to the server, so this is not the issue of locking. Okay? We'll assume that locking is taking place at some different level. Okay? This is just the issue of the multiple writers. They don't have to be even concurrent. Okay, let's assume that application A wrote to the file. Okay, now it's done writing. I mean, it's not closed the file, but that write has finished. Application B is now writing to the same file. Okay, they're not actually happening. So, should you then bring the file over here or just keep it there is the issue. Okay. It doesn't have to be even concurrent in the sense, not in parallel. They just have to have the file open at the same time. They're both writing. So you can't have the primary keep swapping. Because that's too much over it.
So then, the question of local write.
Yes. So when you have concurrent writes to the same file, then you cannot have a local write protocol. Okay. When we again go back to NFS, I will bring this up. Okay, you will see that delegation is only done when there is a single writer in the system. As soon as NFS detects that there are multiple clients writing, it will take that file back and it will revert back to a remote write protocol. So it will dynamically pick. If there's a single writer, it will optimize and say we will delegate. If there are multiple writers, you fall back to remote write. That's exactly what is done in NFS.
Could the write be buffered and then the primary shifted and then it updates the file?
Okay. Question is, could the writes be buffered and you switch the primary? You could do that. The issue here is there's a cost of transferring the file over. Okay, that has to be amortized across multiple writes. So if this is a 100 megabyte file, when you swap off, send up, I mean switch the primary, you are actually sending that file over. So the 100 megabyte that you are transferred, let's say you write 1 byte. Okay, here. So you took 100 megabytes of file, you updated 1 byte. And then here is another concurrent write. That's also writing 1 byte. So now you again send 100 megabytes. So what I'm trying to point out is there is a cost that you pay when you say I switch the primary. And that's the cost of transferring that entire data item. Which could be of arbitrary size. If it's a small data item, sure. Okay, this is not a big deal. But we are not making any assumptions on the size of the data item. So changing the primary incurs a cost. So you don't want to do it if there is a high cost to be paid. Okay. Now there is one limitation of a local write protocol, which is it is stateful in the sense that you have to track for every data item who is the primary. So if this is a file system, there could be millions of files spread across these disks. For each file, you have to keep track of who is the current primary. As the primary changes, everyone has to be notified that this is the new primary. Okay? So there's some state to be maintained on a per item basis. Okay? Rather than in the remote write protocol, you can just pick one primary and that's it. It doesn't change. Here you have to keep track of, as the primary changes, who is the new primary. Okay, so this is the same broadcasting. Okay, so that was where you had the notion of a single primary. Okay, then I also mentioned that you can have this entire other class of protocols that there is no primary. All replicas are treated equal. Okay, these are called replicated write protocols. So the main difference between a primary based protocol and a replicated write protocol is who does the broadcast of the write. Okay. It's clear that all replicas have to receive the update. Okay. Question is, who is responsible for propagating? In a primary base, you send the update to the primary and the primary takes care of sending the update to others. Okay. In a replicated write, the client actually has to send the update to all the replicas. Okay. Because there is no particular replica are designated as primary, so no one is more distinguished than the other, so the client has to deal with it. Okay. So there is no primary, any replica is allowed to update. Here consistency is harder to achieve, yeah, because there is no distinguished machine that is tracking what's happening to the file, who knows about the updates and so on. Okay. So we will look at one class of protocols that you can implement replicated write protocols on, and those are called quorum based protocol. Okay. They use the concept of voting. Okay. It's very simple. You basically vote for doing reads and writes. Okay. And the voting takes place as follows. So assume that there is a single file, okay, that you want to replicate on n servers. you are going to have two types of quorums. Okay, you are going to have a read quorum, which will, and there's a write quorum. Okay, and what you do in this case is, if you want to read the file, you take at least the that many servers that you have in the read quorum and ask them saying, I want to read this file. And they all have to vote on this is the most recent version of the file. And if the vote agrees, then you're guaranteed that you're getting the most recent version of the file. If they disagree, that means that some machines have seen more recent updates that others have not, which is why they are not agreeing. Okay? I'll explain this in using an example in just a second. But the protocol is very simple. You have a read quorum and you have a write quorum. To do a read, you have to contact at least as many servers that you have in the read quorum, and they will all read the file for you and they will vote. And if they all agree on the file version, then you have the most recent version. And to do the write, you do the same thing. You actually contact at least NW servers from your system and send them the write, and they all have to update the file. Okay? So it is voting based. So you contact at least NW servers and get them to do an update. Read is a contact majority of the servers. So here is an example of how this works. Okay? So we'll assume that there are 12 servers in the system labeled A through L. Okay? So there are three examples shown here. The first example, the read quorum is 3, the write quorum is 10. Okay? So what that means is, to read a file, you have to contact at least 3 of those servers. Any 3, doesn't matter which 3. Okay? Pick 3, and if all 3 servers agree that this is the most recent version of the file, you are guaranteed that that is indeed the most recent version of the file. Okay? And to do a write, you have to contact at least 10 servers out of this 12. It doesn't matter which 10, pick any 10 and send them, saying, here is a write, and they will all update the files. So now let's assume that the files, you have a version number, which is an integer that is tracking how many updates have occurred to the file. Every time you do an update, that version number is incremented. Okay? Voting simply takes place by comparing the version numbers. If they all agree on the version number, okay, then this protocol, as we have stated, is going to guarantee you that you actually have the most recent version. Okay? And it's very clear from the picture as to why this will work. Okay? The way you have picked the size of the read quorum and the write quorum actually matters in this case. Okay? We have picked it in such a way that if your read quorum actually agrees on the version number, it's guaranteed that you have actually gotten the most recent version. So in this, let's look at the example that's shown here. The dotted line shows you a write quorum that you picked. Okay? And you've updated the file. Okay? In other words, all machines except A and B actually have seen an update. So the worst thing you could do when you want to read this file subsequently is pick a quorum that includes either A or B or both. So in particular, you pick these three machines, A, B and C. Okay? Now A and B did not see the update, so they have an older version of the file. Okay? C has seen the update, so it has a newer version of the file. Okay? So when this read request goes into the system and you picked a read quorum of 3, A, B and C, what's going to happen? Yeah. So your voting is going to fail, okay? Because here we might have version 1 and this guy has seen an update, so he has version 2. So the A, B and C will vote saying, what version do you have? Vote fails. Okay? So the read request is going to come back to you saying the vote has failed, try again. Okay? So then you pick another 3 servers at random. Okay? And you are always guaranteed that if the vote succeeds, you have the most recent version. So in particular, if you pick I, J and K this time, and you send this read request again, they will again vote. All of them have version 2 of the file. Okay? Now this has guaranteed you that you actually have the most recent version in this example. Okay? There is no way for you to pick a server that hasn't seen the update and cause that vote to actually succeed, because of the way you picked the read and the write quorum. And the property you wanted to ensure is that the write quorum has to be always a majority. Okay, so if you have n servers, you always send the write to at least half of those servers. Okay? And then you ensure that the property is the size of the read quorum and the size of the write quorum has to be strictly greater than the number of servers in the system. If you pick your read quorums and the write quorum so that they satisfy this property, you are always guaranteed that whenever a vote succeeds, you will have the most recent version. You will never have a vote that succeeds where all of those machines in your read quorum actually have an older version of the file. So here is an example where we'll see a slightly different scenario. So here you pick the read quorum to be 7, a write quorum to be 6. Okay. So what happens now? Okay, so let's start with the write scenario. Okay, so you have a write, let's say you picked D, H, L, I, J, K, these 6 machines in the dotted line. Okay, they are updated. Okay. Now for sake of argument, let's pick the another write. Okay. And this other client, let's say, picks A, B, C, E, F, G. Okay, the exact opposite, the machine that did not participate in the first write. Okay. So these are one version, these others have another version. Okay. Is the scenario clear, what I just said? You have two writes that have taken place. The first write actually picked A, B, C, E, F, G, which are these machines. Second write picked these other machines. You know, so there are two writes that have taken place one after another. Now the problem that you have gotten into is, if you have this scenario, no read request is ever going to succeed. Okay? Because no matter how you pick 7 servers, okay, some will be in this group and some will be in the other group, and they will always have a version conflict in this system. Okay, so you can actually perform writes, but no read will succeed in this scenario, in this particular example. Yes, there's a question.
In the case of the word conflict, would it the higher version number be given preference?
The question is, in the context of a conflict, will the higher version number be given preference? You could do that if you knew that that was actually the most recent version. Okay? In this case, version numbers we don't know. So suppose if both started with version 1. Okay? These writes actually cause this version number to increment to 2. This other write has actually also caused that version number to increment to 2. So that's an example of something not working right. Okay. Now the problem we are seeing here has arisen because of the particular choice of the read and write. Okay. I said the write quorum has to be strict majority. Okay. 6 is not a strict majority. Okay, because you have 12 servers, that's not a strict majority. Okay, if you look at this example here, this NW has to be strictly greater than N over 2. Okay? What that says is, for this property to be true, which means that you actually, whenever a vote agrees, you get the most recent version. Okay? And there is some way you can actually pick these servers to get the most recent version, then you should pick NW to be at least 7. Here, bad things don't happen. You will never get an old version, because no read is succeeding. The system is still giving you safety property, which says that I will never return a bad version. But it is not giving you any read that will ever succeed, because you, no matter how you pick this 7, you will pick some from here and some from here. Okay? So it is not giving you an important property called liveness, which is that there is a way to pick a read quorum such that it will succeed. Okay? It may fail some number of times, but eventually it has to succeed. Here it will never succeed. And that is simply because you violated the property we wanted of how to pick the NR and NW. Okay. Here that you actually satisfied that your write quorum was greater than 6, strictly greater than 6. By not doing that, you get all these problems. Okay, yes, question. Yeah.
First case we saw that it's picking any 3 and the write is satisfied.
The read is satisfied. It is not always. I mean, in this case, it's not satisfied, and that's exactly what you should do, because you did. So A, B, and C.
But why is it not satisfied in a few times? Because it reads A, B, and C.
Yeah.
And C has an updated value.
Yeah.
And since it is reading from multiple clients, it has a way to see which is the updated one.
Yeah, so, okay, so you are asking why is it not satisfied. The protocol is very simple. I mean, the version number is not really part of the protocol. That's just something I added for ease of understanding. All you have to do is you basically pick a read quorum, okay, and then you have to vote on the contents of the file. So in reality, what you might do is not keep version numbers, but you actually do byte by byte comparison. Like, are these files identical or not? If all servers return identical copies of the files, you say this is the most recent version, you are guaranteed that. Okay? So you are doing actually strict voting, not voting based on version number. That's something that I have just added. So in this case, A, B and C are going to, A and B will have one version of the file, C will have another version of the file. You do byte by byte comparison, they don't match. So you say vote failed. You don't know which one is more recent. Okay? Okay. Is that clear?
Yeah.
What I just said?
The protocol is satisfied, right?
Yes, yes. Okay, so let me rephrase the protocol. Maybe the what I said was not clear. So the read protocol is as follows. Contact NR servers. Okay? And if those versions match, then you are guaranteed that that's the most recent version. That doesn't say that any, no matter what your choice of NR is, the vote will match. Okay? It might fail, but then you retry. Okay? You keep trying until you have a successful vote, and when it matches, you are done. That's what it says. You might take multiple attempts to get a vote that matches. All that is saying is, when it matches, you are guaranteed. So in particular, if you pick A, B and C, this is a vote that will fail. Okay? Then you try again. So maybe you pick A, E and I. It's again going to fail. Okay? But eventually you will pick something from this set. Okay? So let's say you pick E, F and G. At this point it will match. At this point the system guarantees to you that is what those servers have returned to you is the most recent version. That's the protocol. It doesn't say that just because you picked it this way, the first attempt to read will succeed. All that is saying is if the vote is successful, then you have the most recent version of the file. Vote may not succeed, then you have to keep trying. And the point I was making here is no matter how you pick your read quorum, the vote will always fail. Because NR has chosen to be 7. You have one update that's seen here. So these guys have one version of the file, these guys have other versions of the file, and you always have to, because NR is 7, you always have to pick at least one from the other group. And they will always disagree. So they will never agree. Okay, so that was the point I was trying to make. So in this case, eventually you will succeed. In this case, you will never succeed. Your read, you can keep on trying, but it will never work. Okay. So here is a final scenario. So this is a scenario where you contact exactly one server in your read quorum, and it is always guaranteed to give you the most recent version of the file. So you don't really have to vote. You want a property where you pick any server at random. You contact that server and it's guaranteed that that server actually has the most recent version of the file. So if your read quorum is set to 1, the only way you guarantee that server returns you the most recent version of the file is by setting the write quorum to be the entire set. Okay, so the write quorum is 12, so every write has to be sent to everyone. Okay, that's the only way you will ensure that if the read quorum is 1, that any server you pick at random has words with itself, so it will just return that file to you without any further interactions, and you are guaranteed that it's the most recent. So this is called read once, write all, read one, write all, okay, or ROA. Okay, that's a particular version of the Giffords. So this is, by the way, called Giffords quorum based protocol. It's a voting based protocol for your replicated system. Yes, you have a question there.
But even that we have a problem because, okay, here we are working that AWS 12,
yeah.
You read one, so any particular read is guaranteed. What happens if AWS 11 and NR is 1? So you will have no way of knowing the version is correct.
That's the problem, right? So first, if you want a property, you have to ensure that those conditions are met. The condition was NW is greater than 6. True. NR plus NW should be strictly greater than N. In this case, it adds up to 12. So you cannot actually, this is not, doesn't violate that. So at least if NW is 11, this has to be at least 2. Okay, that's the only way you will satisfy it. Any other questions? Okay. So the last, I mean, these are just some closing thoughts. So I did mention this last time. So we have actually looked at data replication in this entire set of lectures. Okay. I also mentioned at the very beginning that we have compute replication. Okay. You actually replicate, when you do replication, you replicate code and you replicate data. We didn't really look at replicating code at all. Okay. We will come back to this when we do look at the web and content distribution systems and so on. In this context, I had also mentioned replica placement is a big problem. Okay? We have not really thought about, when we pick reads and writes replicas, as to where to put the replicas. Okay? We just said we'll pick a primary at random. Okay? In many cases, where you place the primary actually has an impact on performance. This is a performance issue, not a correctness issue. Okay? Okay? If you put the replicas closer to where the clients are, clients will see better performance. That was the motivation for the local write protocols. Okay? But in general, if you want to just pick replicas, replica placement, okay, is an important problem that you have to address. Okay? In the context of very large systems like the web, where you put your content actually matters, because clients will perceive latency whenever they request this content or using HTTP. Okay? So, and there are many scenarios there. You can actually do mirroring, where you mirror the content in multiple locations, or you can do on-demand replication, okay, where which is similar to the primary moves from one place to another. Replicas come and go. Okay? You put replicas where there is demand, and when the demand goes away, the replica also goes away. So you can decide how you place the replicas, either statically or dynamically, based on how the requests are coming into your system, because you may not be able to predict your workload ahead of time. Again, something we will talk about when we come back to chapter 12. Okay. So the most interesting scenario of replication that we look at in this course is web replication of web content. So there are many other kinds of replication, okay, but all of this theory that we have looked at, we will instantiate when we look at content distribution servers, which are a network of web proxies. Okay, these are network of web caches. Caches are placed at multiple locations. They cache a subset of the content that clients are accessing, okay, over the web. Okay. You have to ask several questions. Okay, so you have a cache that is caching web pages from servers. Okay. How do you ensure that any content you have is up to date in the context of the web? So suppose you cache the CNN page. Okay. Web browser request comes in, says I want www.cnn.com. You have a cache hit because it's already cached. Okay. So you could return that page. Okay. But before you do that, you better make sure that the version you have is the same as what is on the server. The servers have actually seen an update in the meanwhile. Okay. You have an older version on the page. Okay. So how do you guarantee that any cached content is up to date? This is the same problem of ensuring cache consistency. Okay. Any update anywhere either has to be broadcast, or you have to know that an update has taken place. So we will look specifically how you solve this in the context of the web. Okay. Other systems may make other choices, but we'll see. So that's the problem of whether you send updates or you invalidate cache content. There's a notion of push and pull. Okay. Do you pull content and replicate it, or does the server actively push content out? Okay, if you know that some page is going to be popular, a push-based approach of is better, because you can push the content out, and there are multiple replicas, they always have most up-to-date content. Okay. If there is infrequently accessed content, then a pull-based approach is better, because the server doesn't have to do unnecessary work. Even if it is updated, you don't want to send the page if nobody wants to access it. Okay. So what this also says is, depending on the popularity of web pages or web content, you may pick different approaches to implement your cache consistency protocol, either a push-based protocol or a pull-based protocol. And then the last point is whether your cache mechanism is stateful or stateless. Okay, if the server has to keep track of which proxies have the content and actively push update, the server is keeping state, okay, saying who has cached copies of my page. There may be thousands, millions of caches. Do you want to keep state of all of the machines out there? Then maybe that's too much. Okay? But if you're stateless, then you don't know who is caching what. So if you see an update, you can't notify any of the caches saying the web page has changed. Okay? Again, we'll look at all of this in lot more detail. This is just a glimpse of how some of these ideas will get instantiated, at least in the context of replication in the web. Okay. Something we'll come back to in two or three chapters. Okay, your question there.
Won't it be optimal if the main server which is hosting the tables use a push-based approach whenever it has to put it to the edge server, and
okay,
those managing the things close to the client is as in whenever pages are requested for them,
like okay. So you are asking whether isn't it better if the server used a push-based approach and the leaves you used. Okay. So, what is between the main server and the edge server? So, you said there's a server. Let's say it's a web server.
The main server is one that actually, normally in content distribution network trackers, it's like the whole database is hosted or something, and those are replicated across multiple edge servers,
yeah,
so that they are closer to the client.
Okay. So, you are assuming that first of all, that there is even a hierarchy that you are implicitly assuming. What if there are only two types of entities, web servers and caches? Okay, who is going to do push, who is going to do pull? Okay. What you said is valid, but under a scenario where there is some hierarchy of replicas and updates are trickling through this tree, okay, and then you are saying let's use push here, and then these would use pull to actually pull content.
Okay.
Now I understand what you're saying. So you're saying here is a browser that actually asks for some content. At this page point, you will pull something from the server and cache it. That is indeed true. Okay. Now there are scenarios where you may, based on past history, you may decide that certain content will become popular. Okay. So let's suppose that there's a live webcast of some event. Okay. Let's say you are broadcasting the World Cup soccer final. Okay. It's a video webcast. And you know where the popular hotspots are going to be. These are places where soccer is popular. So you can pre-seed this content in those caches and push them out rather than waiting for somebody to request. Because you know it's very popular, your servers are likely to be overloaded, so aggressively push content out. Okay, so in scenarios where you can predict, it's better to push. And so long as you know that the push is beneficial. When you cannot predict, you rely on pull. Okay, that's how most of these caches will work. We'll come back to all this. We can discuss this when we do CDNs. Okay. So, in any case, I mean, the final point I want to sort of make here is we have studied the range of consistency models. Okay. And there is always a trade-off between the correctness guarantee you are going to provide and the cost you will pay to implement those correctness guarantees. The stricter guarantees you want to provide, the higher is the cost of implementing that consistency protocol. Okay. So in any application, you have to make a choice. What is the strictest guarantee you want, but you don't want to do anything more than that. Okay. So you can get away, or in other words, you pick the weakest possible guarantee that is still tolerable to the application. And you don't want to pay any higher price than that because that is good enough. Okay. So this is a choice one has to make when you write an application. Okay, it's all fine to say I want strict consistency, I never want out of date content, but that is very expensive. Okay, you will see that even in the context of the web, you don't do this. The web caches might actually have stale content in many cases. So this is a design choice for any application that implements replication. Okay, so you have to, so the designers has to make this decision what to pick depending on the scenario. Okay, and as I said, we will at least look at how we can implement this in the context of the web, but there will be many other scenarios. In some cases, you want stricter than the other. So this is something to keep in mind. So the strictest ones are typically distributed databases. Okay, because they provide asset properties, they are always consistent. Okay, they actually pay the extra price. Okay, if you have a record in your database system, it's a relational database system and you replicate it, it will always ensure strict consistency. Whether your application needs it or not, that's the way they work. Okay, because if you guarantee asset properties, you can't have different versions of the record or some are out of date. Okay? Alright, so that's basically the material on consistency and replication. So what I will do now is just give a quick 10-15 minute introduction to the next chapter, which is fault tolerance. Okay, this is just motivation. We'll actually talk about fault tolerance in the context of distributed system next time. Okay. So why do we care about fault tolerance? Okay. So we know about single machine system. Okay, failures in these systems are all or nothing. If you have a laptop, your laptop crashes, it stops working. Okay, any applications on this machine stop working. Now in a distributed system, this need not be the case. Okay? Because you have multiple independent nodes, the crash of any single node in the system does not have to take down the entire system. Okay? It may take down the entire system if that machine is a single point of failure. If you kept something critical on that machine and that machine went down, your system is going to just stop functioning. Okay? But if you design your system carefully, because you have n nodes, you have the ability to tolerate single node failures without actually bringing your system down. The question is, what are the principles you will use to design systems, distributed system, that will actually have that property? Right? Now, that's one side of the picture, saying distributed system allow you to provide higher availability. The other side of the story is distributed system should think about availability, because the probability of failures in distributed systems is also higher than failures of single system. This should also be clear, because it says that if you have, let's say P is the probability of any single machine failing. Okay? If you have n nodes in the system, what is the probability that any one, at least one node has failed? Okay, or let's P be the probability that node doesn't fail. Okay, 1 minus P is the probability that a node fails. Okay, it doesn't matter. Pick one of these. So it's 1 minus p to the power n is the probability that any node has actually failed. And that's because p is the probability that node has not failed. So the probability that any node has failed is 1 minus the probability that no node has failed, which is exactly this, p to the power. So as n goes to infinity, meaning the system becomes larger, okay, this is going to go to 1. So what this says is that in very large distributed systems, failure is the common case. Okay, in a, take any large system, some number of nodes are always down. Okay, so this is the other side of the picture. So if you actually build a distributed system, okay, which is large, you have to assume that nodes are going to fail and you want a system to work, even though the node. So let's say you have systems like Google or Amazon, which have 10,000, 100,000 servers. Okay. Some fraction of their servers are always down. Maybe 1 or 2% of the nodes will always be out of service. Okay? Software may have crashed, no hardware may have died. Okay? You don't want, let's say, the web search engine to stop working just because 10 nodes failed in the system. So there are two issues. One is distributed system, because there are multiple nodes, allow you to tolerate failures, but larger systems actually encounter failures, so you also want to design the system to deal with them. Okay, so that's basically the motivation of why we are even going to look at this. So here's a sort of a historical perspective. Okay, so you know that typically computer systems are not reliable. Okay, unlike things like a TV or your maybe car is not a good example, but you basically most other products that you have are designed to be reliable. Okay, you have a TV, you put it on, it comes on. Okay, you go and turn on your machine, it may not come on. Okay, you might have to reboot it or do something to it. Right? So in other words, the way computing systems have been designed from a reliability perspective has been very different from the way other systems have been designed, like say airplanes or electronic things that you buy. Okay? So and until now, this model was all right, because most of the people who are using computing systems were also people who actually knew something about them. Okay. Now with the growth of internet and everybody has broadband connection, everybody uses computing systems in some shape or form. Okay. To these non-technical users, unreliable systems are not something they really are known to deal with well. Okay, so they want to have the same degree of reliability from their computers as their television. Okay. So why you don't reboot your television? Why should you reboot your computer? Right? So this is the perspective that you have to deal with now. Okay? And this becomes very important, because your system may actually not even be on the desktop. Right? So you have most of your applications are maybe online. So if some online application that you depend on fails, let's say your webmail, Gmail goes down. Okay? That's something that people don't deal with well. I mean, they say, why is it down? Why is it not more reliable? So you have on the one hand lot of people who have never used computers until, let's say, 5-10 years ago, they are beginning to rely on them. Okay? And as you rely on them, you expect that they actually are reliable, so you can actually rely on them. And at the same time, you have all of these other applications that are online, okay, that are distributed, and there are all these spectacular failures where something, Amazon goes down and now money is lost because people cannot buy stuff. Users are frustrated because they expect the system to work as is. Okay. So in other words, what this is saying is you can no longer continue to design systems the way you have done for the past 30-40 years. Okay. Because until then it used to be a niche product that people who are tech savvy used, and somehow he got away with saying if a machine doesn't work, reboot. Okay. This doesn't work anymore. So you want your systems to be more reliable. And today's systems by default are distributed. So then there's a question of what principles should you use to implement distributed systems in a reliable fashion. How would you design online banking systems that don't fail, even if some systems, some sub-components of those fail. Okay. How do you design an online stock trading application? How do you design email, web mail, so that it never goes down? Okay. So that's, those are kinds of problems that sort of interest us from a distributed systems perspective. Okay. So that's the motivation. So now let's start thinking about basic concepts. So here we'll talk about the need to build dependable systems. So these are systems that fail very rarely. Okay, no system can be 100% reliable. Okay, this is going to fail, but you want to make the probability of failure, okay, as small as possible. So typically in computing systems, you have this availability matrix. It's typically called 4 or 5 degrees of 9 reliability. Okay, so if you have 5 degrees of 9, this is 99.999% reliability. Okay, that means that the downtime for the system, okay, if you have 5 degrees of 9, the downtime of the system is like an order of minutes every year. Okay? So any system that guarantees you that, that's basically saying the system as a whole cannot be down for more than a few minutes. Okay? And this is independent of what you are doing. Okay? You might have to do software upgraders, you might have to install security patches, you might have to do generic maintenance. Okay? And even if you do all of this, the whole system cannot be shut down. Okay? You may shut down parts of the system, upgrade them independently while something else is happening, but as a whole you don't want the system to be. That's very hard to achieve. Very few systems would do that. Okay, you have to actually have lots of reliability or sort of redundancy, not reliability, at every layer of the system, from the hardware to the applications. Okay, only then can you actually implement it. So it's expensive, but that's basically what the most reliable systems would do. Okay. So that's availability. Okay, so that says a system should be available for use at any given time. The metric typically is a percentage of the time the system is up. Okay, that's the availability metric. Okay. Reliability is slightly different from availability. Reliability says the system should continue to function without failure. That's called a reliable system, okay, as opposed to available system. Okay. Safety basically says that small failures shouldn't cause catastrophic failures. Okay. Safety basically is you should have enough redundancy in your system that minor failures shouldn't cause problems. So computing systems controlling an airplane, okay, have to satisfy that property. Okay. If some small component on the plane shuts down, you shouldn't have the plane as a whole to have a catastrophic problem, because you have to install in sufficient redundancy to prevent these problems from occurring. Okay. So in very critical systems, safety is a very important issue. Okay. And then maintainability basically says a failed system should be easy to repair. Okay. Because failures are going to be the common case in very large distributed systems, maintainability also becomes important. Okay. Because some fraction of nodes are down, you want to put them back in service. Okay. The easier it is to do that, the less of an overhead it is for you to run the system. Okay. So you want systems to be available, reliable, safe and maintainable. Those are sort of the properties that we care about from a dependable systems perspective. Okay. Now those are the properties you want. Now there are different types of failures. We haven't actually classified what types of failures can occur. Okay. This is a very abstract definition of three types of faults. Okay. Transient faults, intermittent faults and permanent faults. So transient faults basically say this is a fault that comes in and goes away and never comes back. Okay, that's called a transient fault. It can occur for any number of reasons. Electricity surge causes the voltage on some component to go above its stated value, so it malfunctions, and when the electricity supply goes back to normal, fault is gone, never reappears. Okay, intermittent fault says that the fault keeps reoccurring, okay, but is never always there. Okay, so it comes and goes, but it is there in the system. And permanent fault just says the system has just gone. I mean, it's failed. Okay. So there are these types of faults, and the system should provide you a service, rather a correct service, despite any of these. Okay, you want to deal with all of these types of faults. Okay, that's basically instantiated here in sort of a different, along a different dimension. Okay, so again, you are trying to classify faults, but now you are doing it in a different way. So you have soft, this is, let's say, software system. So you have crash failures where the system just crashes, it halts. Okay. You may have omission failures where the server is actually running, but it is failing to respond to incoming requests. Okay. This may happen if your server is overloaded. Okay. You may start dropping requests. Okay. You may get an error saying server busy. We frequently see this on web servers that get overloaded. Okay. That's an example of omission failure. The server is still running, just cannot handle the volume of requests. Okay. Timing failure says that the server's response time is exceeds a certain threshold. Okay. And typically for normal operation, you want the response time to be you want the response time to be below a certain time interval. So this can arise in multiple scenarios. Video streaming is a good example, okay, where you want certain timing properties. You want the data to arrive on time. Okay. Just because the data came doesn't mean that the service is working well. It needs to actually arrive on time. Okay. We talked about this earlier. So that's timing failure. Response failure says that the server is responding, but it is sending back garbage, okay, incorrect responses. And arbitrary failures, which are also called Byzantine failures, say that the server may do arbitrary things at arbitrary times. Okay. Sometimes it may look like the server is working well, sometimes it may send garbage, okay, sometimes it may not send anything. Okay. So you can have any arbitrary combinations of these. Okay. And not only that, the type of failure may keep changing. These are the worst kinds of failures that we will call Byzantine fault. Crash failures are the simplest. Server just stops. So you know something is wrong. Okay. In these cases, sometimes you don't know what is wrong. Yes, something is not right, but exactly what's the problem may not be clear. And arbitrary failures makes your life very difficult. It basically, the type of failure may itself keep changing. So what we will do next time is actually look at a sequence of protocols that allow us to deal with some of it. Okay. This is basically the most complex type of failures, Byzantine faults, and how to handle that is an important area of research. I mean, there's still ongoing work on how to do this well, but we'll look at some examples of how one could implement this in distributed systems. Okay. So let's stop here for today. Just to re-emphasize, there is a project that is due. Okay. I'm not sure whether we should have any extra office hours. Okay. Are you able to meet with the TAs and get the questions answered? Do you need us to do something special day or two before the deadline to answer more questions? Last time we actually held extra office hours, but nobody apparently showed up. That's what TA Vimal said. So I don't know if I should repeat that or just let your questions be on demand. Any questions on, you have something to say?
No. I think I showed up.
So. Okay, you showed up. Okay, maybe no one except you came. But basically we had a 3-hour slot and it wasn't used well. So I could just leave things as is. We have office hours practically every day of the week. So you can come and talk. You can. So many of you send email already. That's working well. I'll leave it at that. If not, I can have either Vimal or me. You can have office hours sometime this week, extra in addition to the ones we have. Okay. So think about it. If there's problems, let me know. Okay. Thanks. He wants to do it?
Yeah,
okay, that's fine. Are you the only ones who have this conflict? Only the two of you have this? Okay. I mean, I was okay with that also, but if he is already